Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
This is Alan Weiss, author of the Brand Benefits Playbook: Why Customers Aren't Buying What You're Selling and What to Do About It. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And to make sure you never miss an episode, you have a few options. The best way is to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, or go to marketingbookpodcast.com and sign up for email notifications. Or if you're on LinkedIn, find the Marketing Book Podcast page and click the subscribe button and maybe meet some of your fellow listeners. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Alan Weiss to talk about the book he has co-authored with Debbie McInnes, The Brand Benefits Playbook: Why Customers Aren't Buying What You're Selling and What to Do About It, published by Matt Holt. Alan Weiss, PhD, is the founder and CEO of Marketing Profs, the largest B2B marketing training, consulting, and event company dedicated to helping large organizations, teams, and individuals execute marketing campaigns that drive actual results. He's also a consultant, conference speaker, and emeritus professor at the University of Southern California, home of the Fighting Trojans. Dr. Weiss has developed a rigorous process for benefit positioning in his consulting with global technology companies. His work can be seen in tech brands, including Intel and Texas Instruments, to name just a few, as well as in categories like banks and insurance companies. And interesting facts: he has an engineering degree and was in a band that opened for major recording acts like Lynyrd Skynyrd, Bonnie Raitt, and Kenny Loggins. Dr. Weiss, congratulations on the Brand Benefits Playbook, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, hopefully that brought you down memory lane there.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, Dr. Yeah. Weiss, may I call you Alan?
Just call me Alan.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
So, listen, a lot of authors will put themselves there in great reputational risk by coming on this podcast, but I don't want you to feel like you've entered some kind of a danger zone. Now, what I do want to say is this is an Alan-friendly podcast.
Oh,
my oldest brother, my father, and grandfather, all named Alan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so you would be quite at home.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. Alan Burdett, Alan Sr., Alan Jr., Alan the Third. So, yeah, there you go. So now, I want to ask you, when you were in a band, this band where you opened for these big acts, you survived having a cherry bomb thrown on the stage. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's when Harvard asked me if their students were so difficult. I said I was able to handle that, without getting upset. So, that's how I answered it. But it's true.
And then Harvard said, well, we don't know. We're not so sure about you. But Stanford said, that's great, right?
Yeah. Well, Harvard thought that I was a dilettante because I had an engineering degree, and then I have a master's in counseling psychology, and then I was a musician. And then, by the time I went on the market, it seemed like I just was jumping around all over the place. And so, so they thought I was a dilettante.
Well, how you feeling now, Harvard? So when you were in that band, what did you play or what did you do in the band?
Oh, well, I was a songwriter. Oh. And so I wrote the songs, but I grew up, in a family where my father was a musician. And so I learned to play cello, piano, drums, and guitar. And so when I was in the band, I played piano and guitar, but most of what I did was I wrote the songs and I did half of the singing. And so, it was fun. It was a great time. I'm really glad I did it.
That's great. Well, now I don't expect you to remember this because I'm not a very memorable person, but we once had lunch together.
Oh.
It was at the Marketing Profs B2B Forum in Boston.
Oh, really?
And they were serving lunch, and they had all these tables out there, and I sat down across from you, and I introduced myself and looked at your name tag, and it said that you were with Marketing Profs. So in a pretty smooth move, I said, "So, Alan, what do you do at Marketing Profs?" And you were very nice, and you said, "Well, I'm the founder." At which point, I said the following:
"I'm not a smart man."
But I always appreciate that, and that was terrific. A great event, and it was at that hotel, the Westin, I think, near the Boston Convention Center.
Yeah. That was a great hotel too.
Yeah. So now your co-author Debbie McInnes is very attractive. And I wouldn't be surprised if she's a Marketing Book Podcast listener.
Yeah. She's actually my wife.
Oh, hey now. Whoa. Well, that's great. And I can respect that you want to keep me away from her. And that's,
you're
taking the flack here. So that's great. I enjoyed reading that. And it brought to mind a story from another author named Tom Martin, who you may have met. He wrote The Invisible Sale. And years ago, I was interviewing him. I liked his book very much. And I was chatting with him afterwards, and I said, "Hey, I liked your book so much. Do you think you might want to write another one?" And he says, "You know, it's funny. I was at a cocktail party recently, right when my first book was being launched, and I heard someone say to my wife, 'Oh, do you think Tom might want to write a second book?' And he heard her say, 'I don't know. Why don't you ask his second wife?'" So I have to admire that the two of you wrote this together, and that's terrific. So, well, great. Well, listen, I want to quote from the very beginning of the book, and then we can get into it. You write on the very beginning, you write, "Some of the greatest thinkers in business have emphasized the power of a customer-focused perspective, namely, focusing on what customers want from the things they buy and use. The Brand Benefits Playbook expands on this perspective, showing that a focus on the benefits that customers want in the brands they buy can provide an integrated lens on marketing decision-making, from market segmentation to target segment selection to brand positioning and more. Indeed, the various plays in the book provide a systematic step-by-step approach to the marketing of new brands and existing ones. This integrative perspective is important and unique since marketing decision-making typically lacks a coherent framework. The plays in our playbook are applicable to any marketed entity, not just products or services, but also large organizations, small businesses, startups, experiences, people, nonprofits, and even musical bands. They are also relevant to marketers in business-to-business and business-to-consumer markets. Additionally, most marketing problems can be addressed when organizations focus on the benefits that customers want. For example, consider some examples of problems our clients have commonly expressed, and I just want to read these really quickly because I hear them all the time. I've heard them throughout my career. There's four of them, and the first one is competitive pressures. We're losing too much business to our competitors, or we seem to be in a commodity market. And then as it relates to messaging, our messaging doesn't resonate like it used to, or our messaging is all over the place. We need to get clear. And then for new product launches, we have launched a new product and don't know why sales are so slow, or we're not sure how to easily explain our product's features. And finally, top of the funnel problems. We're not targeting the right customers, or our salespeople are going after the wrong customers. So, Alan, at the very end of the book, you write that a focus on customer benefits is not new, but it is not the way most organizations think. Why is that, do you think?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because the first person who ever talked about benefits was Theodore Levitt. Mm-hmm. He wrote this quip called, "People don't want a quarter-inch drill, they want a quarter-inch hole." And he wrote that in 1960. And he showed how if people really thought about benefits instead of features and all the way that almost every company thinks about it, that they would avoid marketing myopia. You know, they would be able to help, anticipate new competition and provide a clearer path to growth and other sorts of things. But for some reason, and we don't have any understanding of why it is that marketers and companies have never really followed that advice.
It's funny. And marketing myopia, we may talk about that again here. Yeah, there was a Harvard Business Review article in 1960, and it just keeps coming up over and over again. And I know this is a little inside baseball, but I recently interviewed Dr. Philip Kotler again, and he referred to Theodore Levitt as Ted. Right. Yeah. Ted Levitt. Yeah. But they knew each other. So now let's back to Debbie McInnes. Now, you write in the book that you learned from Debbie that while organizations make products, customers buy brands. Explain what's going on there.
Well, if you think about it, she was right, because when you start looking around and you start thinking about, like, everything that you buy is a brand, and that's the first thing that comes to mind. And, you know, think about it, like, if you ask somebody, like, what kind of phone do you have, they're not going to say, oh, I've got I've got this kind of screen, I've got this thing. They say it's like an iPhone, right? That's the first thing that comes out of their mouth. Or, you know, I've got a Bolt car or something like that. It's always a brand. And she comes much more from the customer side of things. I've always done more B2B types of stuff. But it really is true. You know, I've heard some people who said, I don't like the idea of brand positioning. They think that there's something wrong with that. But in fact, when you get a customer's viewpoint, that's exactly the way that people think about it, you know. And so I eventually came along, and we started writing this book together because she had actually written a book called Brand Admiration a number of years ago, and which they showed that the most admired brands in the world actually focused on benefits. And so I just came along for the ride, and it was. But as the more we talked, the more I kind of changed my whole perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
But okay, well, so you've married well, and Well, let's get a couple terms properly defined, because I think we're starting to use some terms that I think are widely used and even more widely misused. So, for the sake of debate, explain what a brand is and what a benefit is, and if you would, explain why we shouldn't confuse benefits with product features.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to explain. First of all, let me explain what benefits are, because I think this is where people trip up. There's actually three types of benefits. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the easiest way to think of the three types is, well, let me first explain what they are. They're functional, symbolic, and experiential. And you might think of the functional ones being like what it does for me. And the symbolic ones is like who I am, and the experiential ones is how I feel. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you might think of functional as solutions to problems and challenges that are large and small, or something that saves resources like time or money.
That would be functional, right?
Yeah, that would be functional. Right. Yeah, so simple ones that show up in, like, you know, a lot of markets, especially in technology, are things like reliability, because that means it doesn't break down or cause problems, etc. Or something like ease of installation, that really saves time and resources. So the functional are the simplest ones to understand, because those are ones that, you know, we deal with all the time. And technology, B2B companies deal with a lot of functional benefits.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when you get into symbolic benefits, which are much more subtle, it's usually like, I want something that expresses like my coolness or uniqueness or moral values or group membership. So think about, like, Patagonia says, we're in business to save our home planet. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when people, like, you know, respond to that as a thing, then they go, oh, I'm the kind of person who wants to, you know, save our planet. Or St. Jude's Children's Hospital that says finding cures and saving children. Or Nike, who just do it, you know. Or you can just think about, like, Apple. When Apple came out with their iPhone, one of the big ads was like showing people who were cool. Okay.
Yes, right. And think different.
And
yeah.
Yeah, and so that's a symbolic benefit. And then the third one is experiential, and that can be anything from, like, you know, something that evokes in you like a nostalgia or excitement, or something that's pleasant to look at or taste or hear. So think of it as like music, which is experiential. A wonderful meal can be experiential. But, you know, again, I'll go back to Apple. Like, they made opening a box of technology, this whole experience of touching the box. And, you know, there was like thousands and thousands of videos of now people who just say, let's open the box up. And it's like, you know, it's this kind of like, they just want to touch it and you know, and pull the strings and all of that. That's very experiential. Mm-hmm. And so you get these three types of benefits that make up markets, and symbolic and experiential benefits show up a lot in consumer markets, and which it would show up, like, I'm doing, let's show you how wide and varied this is. I'm doing work right now for a major city in California. I can't mention the city, but, you know, when they start thinking about, like, economic development, some of the benefits that come out of that market are actually symbolic. You know, because they really go to, like, okay, who am I as a company? You know, do I want to be this kind of, like, you know, let's say that, you know, they care about green energy because they want to save the world, okay? And so that would be a symbolic benefit. And so these types of benefits, you know, basically comprise markets. My experience is that markets tend to have 8 to 10 benefits. And, you know, B2B markets tend to have like 8 to 10 functional benefits, whereas you get into some, you know, consumer packaged goods, and they can have 8 to 10 of a combination of these types of benefits. But the real difference between benefits and features is that they have nothing to do with each other. Features give rise to benefits. But as I always say to companies when I'm talking to them about this, I say they don't care about your company. They don't care anything about your company. What they care about is what they get from it. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's the benefit. And so that's the real problem that people run into with benefits is it's two things. It's one, not understanding what they are, and two is not understanding why they're important. And that's what we try to do in the first chapter. We spend a lot of time on, like, you know, that it helps you develop new products. Because, you know, for the years when I taught, you know, when I first came out on the job market, my first job was at Stanford. And I would always, like, when I'm teaching the MBA intro marketing class, people would say, "Oh, marketing, they don't know what they're doing." I mean, they never would have, like, figured out, like, the iPhone until the iPhone came along. They could never have asked customers for it. Mm-hmm. And like we talk about in the book, that, you know, but customers could have told you they want to be cool. And right. They could have said, customers could have told you they want convenience, you know. It was absolutely a no-brainer that people didn't want to have, like, an iPad and an iPod and a phone as separate two separate things that they were carrying around. They'd like to have them combined together.
Yeah.
And so if you know how to, like, look at this, and we also give the example of Uber and how they came in and just completely decimated taxis by just basically giving people a sense of control. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I know where the taxi is. And if you remember, before these taxis came along, before Uber and Lyft came along, you know, you'd feel guilty when you were paying at the end of the ride, because, you know, the taxi driver would say, "Don't you have cash?" And you'd try to use your credit card. And it was this whole kind of debate, and how much do I pay and all of this. And, you know, so
I was usually grateful just to get there alive, but that's because I loaded in a lot of New York City taxis. Let me ask you something about that. Not to put too fine a point on it, but you explain that it's easy to confuse benefits, which we've been talking about, with pain points and goals. Explain what you mean there in terms of pain points and goals. Those aren't necessarily going to point you towards the benefits.
Right. Well, you see, think about it is that benefits reduce pain. Okay. So think of it as, like, it's an outcome of using the benefit. Okay. So it's an outcome of it. A goal is an outcome of this. And a lot of people just say, okay, what's the customer's pain? The trouble is that the pain doesn't necessarily say what are the benefits. So it can one pain can lead to, like, two or three different benefits, but you don't know which one it is. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot easier. I find that it's just a lot easier to just focus directly on the benefits. And that people can actually tell you what they are. Once they understand what they are, people can tell you what benefits are making up a market. That's at least been my experience.
It seemed to be real important to me not to confuse those two, and particularly in selling something, or for all the salespeople listening, that, you know, they say focus on the pain. Well, there's a slight difference here. Now, but you touched on this already, that, you know, the B2B markets largely focus on the functional benefits.
Right.
But what are some ways that B2B brands can or are offering more experiential and maybe even symbolic benefits?
Well, that's a really good question, because when I used to do a lot of work for Texas Instruments, I used to always tell these people, you know, that they should be thinking about symbolic or experiential benefits, and they don't want to do that. You know, they just say, "Oh, that's just something else." But I'd say, look at, you know, people are going to like you a lot more, you know, and so a lot of it is to kind of, like, really uncover by talking to, you know, these buyers, mm-hmm. and saying, okay, so, you know, why do you want that? What are you looking for? And, you know, it's one of the ways that we talk about in the book is, like, you know, laddering, which is a technique for uncovering, these benefits. And you can do this for yourself, is just to look at any product that you have and say, why did I buy that? And you say, oh, I bought it because of, it's whatever. And then you say, well, why did you want that? And if you keep asking why, eventually you're going to come to and see what that benefit is. And you'll just go, oh, yeah, that's why I bought this.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's great. It got me thinking about why I still drive a 21-year-old Toyota.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
I could buy any car I want. And it's like, there's a, I got me thinking, you see, that tingling means it's working. It actually worked on me. I just wanted to telegraph to the B2B listeners, there are big opportunities. If you can do what's right. in the book, and I mean, I was able to figure out how to do this, the experiential and symbolic things can really help enormously. But there's one other thing that I know a lot of listeners, or at least their bosses, are thinking about, and that's a price. So right. you know, you talk about the price of a product or service is one element in the customer's purchase decision, obviously.
Right.
But you write that by itself, price is not a benefit. Explain.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, a lot of it is because price per se is not a benefit, but you know, but we include it all the time whenever we're trying to figure out what are the benefits that make up a market, because a low price, or let's take a high price, for example. A high price could be a bad thing for some people. They'd say, oh, that price is way too high. And for another group, and this shows you how people trade off these benefits, which they don't do with like features and stuff like that so much, but they do with benefits, is that for some people, a high price is a good thing. You know, they just say, oh, it just shows people that I'm a very wealthy person, you know, and I can afford this, you know. And so the perception of the price it can be positive or negative, depending on the segment that you're going after, et cetera. But price per se is not good or bad. It's just what it is. And so, but we always include it as part of the list of benefits that make up any market, because of the fact that people, when they're perceiving it, can perceive it to be a bad thing or a good thing.
Yeah, and I just want to mention a few other things that are in that very first chapter, which was just wonderful. A couple of benefits of taking this approach, and one of them is that by taking this benefits approach, you have a much better sense of your competitors and potential competitors, which we'll talk about, and not just get locked into the usual suspects, because it reminds me of over the years when I've talked to companies, we get to talking about their competition, and they tend to default to other firms that are just like theirs, that are very similar. And I think they completely miss that their customers have other alternatives. And another point is that you touched on this. You say, customers may not be able to tell you what features or attributes they want in a new product, but they can tell you what benefits they want. And I had to chuckle to myself because it brought to mind this tiresome, apocryphal quote from Henry Ford and Steve Jobs. You probably already right. you know about yeah. the folly of asking customers what they want, and those aren't true stories, but it, you know, it makes people think, well, how does a customer even know what benefits they want? Well, it's actually pretty straightforward in the book of being able to get to it, even if they can't articulate it that way. But also, in terms of new product development, you mentioned, and I had never known about this, Eric von Hippel from MIT.
Oh, yeah.
He determined that innovations come overwhelmingly from customers rather than in-house. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. These are called lead users. And it's really interesting because he basically points out that so many of the innovations actually came from customers rather than from manufacturers. And we give the example, you know, of one where, you know, it was just a father who had a daughter who was, you know, was on dialysis. And we tell the story that actually comes from Eric von Hippel about how nobody, you know, provided something that was connected up to the internet so that they could actually monitor their kids if they did sleepovers, you know. And so they actually kind of like re-engineered one of the products to make it work for them. I mean, how many times have you, like, or any of your listeners ever sat around and say, why hasn't somebody come up with a product for this? You know, there's people who say, okay, I'll come up with it, you know, and then they start companies, you know, and it's not because it's really just because the companies themselves, what I always say, they turn inward, you know, yes. They turn backwards into themselves. And again, I see this with cities as well. You know, when I was talking to the mayor of this city, you know, the mayor was saying, oh, yeah, we've done an analysis of you know, the finances and all of this sort of stuff. And I say, yeah, that has nothing to do with customers. You know, that's what's going on with you. I don't care what's going on with you.
Yes. You know, that reminds me of David Merriman Scott, who I'm sure you've met. He gives these talks and he writes about it in his book. And I can remember seeing him give a keynote once, and up on this enormous screen, the headline said, "No one cares about your product but you."
Exactly.
I'm sure he's hurting a lot of feelings, but a lot of people, I mean, he will never stop trying to explain that to companies.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that was interesting. Well, let me just jump ahead to something else that made me wonder. I mean, some of the stuff was a little bit astonishing to me, but maybe it's because I'm too close to it. But you write on page 41 that even if you think you do not have a brand, you do. So do you get a lot of pushback from companies thinking, no, I sell pools, or I sell roofing products, or I sell security software? What? You make this point so strongly. What's right. going on in the mind of the folks that are dismissive of this?
Well, again, I think this is just, I think they're not thinking of the customers.
Yeah.
Like, if you know, they just say, okay, that's why we give this chart, Exhibit 2-1, that just talks about, like, all of these nonprofits and retailers and platforms and people and charities and all of this sort of stuff. But, you know, When you're, you know, like I was doing, like, the digital, I helped position the digital signal processor for Texas Instruments when I was, like, doing a lot of work in technology companies. Well, if you would have gone to, like, somebody who was actually thinking about designing in a digital signal processor, okay, so this is a very technology-oriented product. It's basically a semiconductor chip that sits on a motherboard or something like that. You know, if you would have asked them, I said, okay, so are you buying this? And they would have said, yeah, this is TI's. Okay. They wouldn't say, oh, this is just a digital signal processor. And they wouldn't have used Texas Instruments or ADI or Motorola or anybody else's name, right? They would have just said, it's just a digital signal processor, and it's got this many pins on it, and that's how I describe it to everybody else. No, the first thing they would say is, this is Texas Instruments digital signal processor.
Like what you said about the iPhone. You don't say iPhone.
Yeah. yeah.
Or a Samsung, or whatever, yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly what people do, and that's why I'm saying that's why we're saying. Sometimes you have to be a little bit strong in a book, you know, for people to wake up.
Yeah.
But if you talk to my wife, she really believes this. You know, she's done research on this for her whole career, and so yeah.
Yeah, and well, you know, you all also got my attention again for the same reason when I think it was on page 56. Where you say that you hear from organizations who've positioned their product without ever thinking about how customers actually perceive it. I almost wanted to bury my head in the sand when I heard that. So it's troublesome. Well, let's jump to the chapter on segment on benefits, segmenting. So, you know, talk about what to do if all your customers in your market don't want all the same benefits. So then you segment. And I wanted to quote from page 66, for those playing the home game, where you write, instead of focusing directly on the benefits customers want, most marketing books, websites, consultants, and even marketing professors promote an enormous array of ways to segment a market. So what are some of the ways they are trying to segment, and what are the inherent pitfalls?
Well, I mean, you know, in the book, we show like 52 ways that consumer markets, you know, work, the way they segment it. And I was at a Forrester conference last year.
Yeah, great story. Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because
did you get thrown out for what you're about to tell us?
No. I just went to this presentation, and the people who these were Forrester analysts, you know, and they said, okay, now you need to segment the market, and they showed 26 ways to segment the market, and they basically just said, you figure it out, okay?
That's right.
And so marketers are just confused. I mean, I think this is the reason why vertical marketing became a big deal, in especially in B2B, because people started talking about vertical marketing, you know, retailers versus, you know, healthcare agencies or something like that. Mm-hmm. And to both of us, I mean, we just say, well, okay, those are good as descriptors of who's in this segment.
Which is secondary to the benefits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's much. Once you understand the benefits, you'll start seeing that these healthcare companies or these retailers are in all of these different segments, you know. And so now you start understanding, like, well, why is it that when I sell to like healthcare companies, only some of them want my product? You know, I'll tell you why, because you're doing this all wrong. And so that's been one of our experiences, but it's like one of the things that's like really hard, because people are so entrenched in this kind of like way that they start thinking about their markets, you know.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's a holdover to the days of buying massive amounts of advertising, you know, like targeting men 18 to 34 or whatever. Yeah, so there's all the different ways you talk about, which probably some of the ones that Forrester were talking about, you know, like by geography or by vertical or by age or by psychographics. And it brought to mind the story I've read in a couple of books that talk about these two British guys in their 70s, both of whom were divorced. And so people will think, oh, they've got a lot in common. But it turns out one of them is King Charles III and one of them is Ozzy Osbourne. Two completely different people.
Yeah.
But they'll think, oh, no, that's the same. They're from the same pool. So, yeah. Now, you're not saying also, I just want to be clear for all the haters, you're not saying these things aren't helpful, but they're helpful in their own way. As you said, as a descriptor, don't start with that. Start with the benefit. So
yeah, you start with the benefits. You can use these other things as descriptors. And you need those descriptors because this is a way that you can get to this is the way that you communicate, you know, or I shouldn't say that not what you communicate, but this is the way that, you know, that like, you know, if I'll just use my healthcare as an example. I mean, that's the way that you identify, okay, we need to go to these healthcare companies who are in this segment, okay? And it's easy to find the healthcare companies. Once you start really thinking about how to segment, it becomes a lot more straightforward as to how to find the right healthcare companies. And you can do this with any product or service. I mean, I've done this many, many times, and once I show the benefits, I'll tell you a quick story. Maybe this will help. But you know, when I was doing work for Texas Instruments, I remember I was flown to Germany, and I was sitting there in front of the president of Germany for Texas Instruments and all of the VPs, and I had to do this presentation, and I was just doing it on the fly. I was just saying, okay, I just asked them, I said, okay, I explained what benefits were, like functional benefits, and I asked them to list them down. I listed them down on the board, and then I just took two of them, and I said, do you know any any customers who just really care about these two? And immediately people said, oh, yeah. And they started talking about all these people who just cared about those two benefits.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, well, what kind of products do they make? And they were able to say, oh, they make these kinds of products. Those are the descriptors, the kind of products that they were making. And so my experience is that while this just seems really hard to do, et cetera, and maybe it is, maybe, quite frankly, maybe it is because I've been doing it for so long, that it's pretty straightforward. And once you start thinking this way, everything becomes a lot easier for you.
Yes, yes. You talk about that, how it becomes, you can do your whole job more easily, and the whole organization starts to better understand it. So I just want to mention that, let's say you've done it right. You've started to boil this down by benefits that people want, rather than a
right.
demographic or a vertical or whatever, to try and segment, because you can't go after, I don't think you can ever go after everybody. It's not always a good idea. And you have these questions that you should ask yourself to determine, all right, which segment? And it's like, how big is this benefit segment? Is it growing? What right. are the marketing costs of entering this benefit segment?
Right.
One of them is, does it create any synergies for us now or in the future? Just these answers. I can just imagine you in that same room trying to walk them through and help them see what makes more sense. But what I wanted to do was ask you about the problem. It's a real practical reason why you shouldn't try to position on features, which I see all the time.
Right.
And explain what you mean when you say that when you're trying to position based on features, looking at you B2B tech companies,
right.
The problem is that you say you're asking customers to translate the features into benefits. You're making them have to work too hard. Explain what's going on there.
Right, right. Well, you know, obviously, if I think one of the things that we talk about, and maybe it's just a small section, we just say if you're dealing with experts, okay, experts can translate. If you said, okay, here's these features, they can say, okay, my mind can like figure out what the benefits are. But it's a lot easier, like if your competitor comes along and just says, okay, you're looking for reliability. Okay. And they go, yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Okay. Here's features that give rise to reliability. And, you know, as I always say, the benefit is the headline and the features are like the copy, you know, and so it's not like the features aren't valuable. They
right.
just become
the very copy. Important point you make in the book. You do need the yeah. features, but in the yeah. right order. In other words, they see the benefit. They think, oh, I do want to see about the features now. But if you start right. with the features, it's like, I don't get it. Don't make me work.
Yeah, exactly.
So this next section I wanted to ask you about brought to mind this one line from Steve Martin.
Comedy is not pretty.
It's about positioning statements. You say that, again, this is a term that's probably used and misused. Positioning statements are not pretty. Explain what a positioning statement is, as well as the misconceptions about positioning statements.
Right. Yeah. If you start looking around and seeing how people think about positioning, they think it's like this. They think it just reads more like messaging. You know,
yes.
It's just like this whole thing. And probably the proper way to think about positioning is really through a perceptual map. Mm-hmm. You know, when you see a perceptual map, because that's really where the positioning takes place, is in people's minds. Okay, so just think of it as positioning happens in people's minds,
but not in the mind of the internal people. That's where I often see that mistake made.
Yeah, so a positioning is really just like, what are the benefits? What are the two or three benefits that customer is looking for? Okay, and when it's really good, it's not only that these are the benefits, but it's an understanding of why you can provide those benefits. Okay.
You might not be able to provide them, actually, as alluring as they may seem.
Yeah. I mean, this is why we talk about making sure they're credible and defensible.
Yes.
Yeah, because that's what a lot of people do, is they just kind of like say, okay, I've positioned it. And they're blissfully unaware of competition, right. You know.
Yeah, I love those two plays, those two chapters on these stress tests.
Yeah.
And everyone should have them. And it seemed to me like they're, and I'll explain why in a minute, they're a great thing for marketers to have, because these ideas will get thrown out and you can say, okay, great. Let's put it through the stress test.
Yeah.
And then everyone can see, like, oh, it's not like you don't like it. But you have they're the credibility stress test and the defensibility stress test. And I got to quote this. I want to quote from Sun Tzu, who you quote in the book, who in the Art of
War. I love this.
Yeah, the Art of War. If you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. If you know yourself but not the enemy, for every victory gained, you will also suffer a defeat. If you know neither the enemy nor yourself, you will succumb in every battle. Exactly. So with the idea of know yourself and know your enemy, tell us about the first of the credibility stress test and how it helps organizations to know themselves. And I think that this also wards off a lot of the imposters.
Yeah. Well, knowing yourself is really about understanding whether or not you, as a company, have the strengths, okay, just to be able to provide the benefits the customers are looking for, okay? And, you know, we just say, can your organization pull it off?
Because can they really pull it off?
can they really pull it off?
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, I've worked with companies who get to a point where they basically say, you know, we're saying that we can do this. You know, we're saying that people should believe that we, you know, we can provide this benefit, but we really can't. We can't right now, but we can maybe in the future. And so this is where we start talking about a target migration, you know, path. But you know, that's what you're doing when you're really looking inward. You're really looking to see, okay, do I as a company, or I as a whatever, a service, or it could be a city, or it could be a musical band, or it could be whatever, a small business. Are people in the market going to perceive when I say this that they're going to say, right, you can provide this?
Yeah, okay. And you know what that reminds me of is years ago in my ad agency days, I found this box, a small box of macaroni and cheese, you know, the kind they sell, and it was like an off-brand, and it was had a picture of macaroni and cheese on the front of this thing, and it wasn't even very good photography. It was just cheap, but the brand name was Upscale Mac and Cheese.
right. Okay.
It was the last thing from Upscale, and I can remember bringing this to meetings and having it in my office when some client was starting to do what you're describing there, where it's like, no, you're not Upscale. Don't. That is not believable.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's where the credibility comes in. And, and you're saying that, you know, the credibility can hang over for even lousy stuff, you know.
But it was not Upscale. It was like, no. And then in advertising, you don't necessarily want to say certain things. You want to demonstrate it or convey it in another way. So, So I just thought it was great. And it also gets you've heard of the HIPPO, the highest paid person's opinion. That always carries a lot of weight. So whoever the highest paid person in the room is, their opinion matters more. Well, you know, it's sort of like the sports reporter who can say, well, let's go to the videotape, put it through this stress test. And it's, you know, you're going to not upset people and you're actually going to help the organization.
Right.
So in terms of the competition, talk about the other one, the defensibility stress test, which, and I know I'm kind of twisted, but have you seen these things on the internet where they have these slap fights now? It's not like an arm wrestling thing. It's like they have these These are like championship things where people are two guys are slapping each other.
Right.
That's what the defensibility stress test reminded me of. Like, can we actually do this?
Yeah. Well, the defensibility, I mean, the thing is that, you know, a lot of people, especially nowadays with the internet, you know, there's companies who scrape websites for you and tell you exactly, you know, what your competition is doing. They'll put battle cards together and all of this. We're not talking about things like that. We're talking about it like almost like using game theory.
Yes.
And
dynamic.
And it's a really dynamic thing.
Yeah. It reminded me of what I think the military does a lot of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The military does this. And, you know, and they really think in terms of, okay, if we do this, this is what our competitor is going to do. And if our competitors do this, then this is what we're going to do. And if we do this, how are they going to react? I mean, the classic example that I give this is that, you know, if we lower our price, our competitors will lower their price, then we'll lower our price. The next thing you know, we're in a price war. Now, that's all happening in our mind. So before we do it, why don't we think about a different way of going about this? You know,
right.
And so once you if you play out a game with your positioning, this is the stress test, you can say, okay, if I position myself this way, what's my competitors going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we say, you know, most people who just position their products, they just position it and they just blissfully think that competitors are going to sit there and go, okay, that's great. You can just take the market from me. I don't care. You know, that doesn't make any sense at all, but that's the way they do it.
Yeah.
You know? So what can I say?
But it almost looked like fun. You talk about how you really organize your competitive information into just two categories, ability and motivation.
Exactly.
You know, can they respond that way? And would they, based on what we know about them?
Right. Exactly. So this is a motivation and ability. I mean, there's usually three things that really capture what people are going to do is motivation, ability, and opportunity. But we're assuming that the opportunity is there. And it's really a question of, do they have the motivation to respond? And do they have the ability to respond?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what you'll see is that, you know, maybe you have four competitors and maybe one of them really has this motivation to respond and then they have this ability to respond. And so you can predict if they have the high motivation and high ability, you know, that they will most likely respond once you position yourself, especially if you have a good position. Because if they say, well, look at this, these people just position themselves exactly where I want to be positioned, they're not going to sit there and just say, okay, sure, take the market from me.
Right.
You know, it doesn't work that way. I mean, it'd be great, but, you know, the only way to get around that is to have, you know, where everybody agrees, you know.
Right.
You know, but so we're just putting them through these stress tests to make sure that by the time you have what we call a defensible and credible position in the market, once you have that, then you're ready to go.
Yeah.
The rest of it is just making it happen.
Well, right. And I would talk about that, but like the ability and the motivation, boy, it brought to mind, it made a lens much clearer for me in terms of when you look at international affairs or warring countries or, you know, do they have the ability and will they do anything? So I liked it. I marveled at the simplicity, but how well it worked. So you just started talking about that, which was play number 8. We can't talk about all of them, but that's activate on benefits. And it's all about the rubber hitting the road. And basically none of this approach is effective if you can't make it happen. In fact, if you do all this and don't make it happen, I think your credibility is going to be hurting. And on page 186, you write, executing on your position statement means developing a message platform that includes who you plan to target and with which benefits being central. Executing on the statement also means mapping the customer journey and developing content that reinforces the brand's positioning across all touch points. Let me ask you about two terms. Explain the message platform.
Well, think of a message platform where you take the positioning statement. Okay, so think of a positioning statement is an elegant. It just says exactly what you're trying to do. Okay, and you're then turning it into a platform that would have tell everybody in the company, okay, this is a segment you're going after. These are the benefits that we're going after. Here's some great statements that you can use that have emotional content to them or whatever that you can use as part of your content that reinforce these benefits that we're trying to propose all through the customer's journey. Okay, so think of it as just like a document that you can then send to everybody in the organization who's responsible for this product to make sure that the communications with the customers, because remember, this is happening in the minds of customers, this positioning, and if you don't reinforce that through the customer's journey, then people won't have that positioning in their mind. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you need to reinforce it through the customer's journey, and so that's where the message platform comes in.
Right. Well, you know, you write that in your experience, organizations often try to communicate to the market before thinking about the customer journey. Again, right. Another head slapping moment.
Yeah.
Explain. Say more about why that. What problem that creates. And why you should map the customer journey?
Well, understanding like what the process that people go through, you know, through the search process, the consideration process, and then the choice process. You know, a lot of people think about this like, you know, in B2B, like, you know, using lead generation, you know, that type of a thing.
I think they think about it for about 5 or 10 seconds, maybe.
Yeah. But, you know, what you're really getting to a broader perspective, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, we point out, and this is kind of like well known, that with the internet came along, and now the internet's been around for 25 years or so, even in B2B markets, you know, 75% or so of the purchase process has already been completed by the time somebody will actually contact a company. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas it used to be that, you know, it used to be before the internet came around, the only way that you would know about somebody's product is if a salesperson actually came to you. But now,
right.
people find it out. And where do they find it out? They go to your website, you know.
Right. And for a long time, the big number was 57%. Remember from CEB?
Yeah.
And now you've got in here, I this one from Forrester, you said it was like 80% before they they've already
really
defined what they want before they even reach out.
Yeah, exactly. It's really high. And so, the good news for marketers, you know, is that now they have more responsibility to really make sure that these benefits and these things are really coming through loud and clear to customers. So it changes their perceptions. And that's really what you're trying to do, is to change people's customers' perceptions of how you are on these benefits versus your competitors, which is why you need why a perceptual map is so important for not only deciding where you are at the present time, but also mapping how well you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like a aspirational radar screen. And there's a big section in the book about how to do that. We just didn't get into all the details.
Exactly.
It's very visual.
Yeah.
But also, like Exhibit 8.1, as I look at the book here on page 171, for those who already have the book, it's just great. You know, you've got six different phases, and I think it's helpful if you put these up on the whiteboard, let's say, and then right off the bat, people are going to say, "Oh, God, we're not even thinking about that."
Right.
That whole aspect of the what the customer is doing there. Oh,
yeah.
So it's terrific. So, well, Alan, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Well, I think it's really straightforward. I think if people were going to take only one thing from this whole thing, is to just really think about what are the benefits that customers in your market are looking for. Okay, that would be my main thing. Get out of yourself and get into the customer's viewpoint. Okay, that would be the first thing that I would say.
Yeah, and just so the listener knows, the word benefits is real big on the cover of the book.
Yeah, that's why we make a big deal about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Let's help the listener take that all important first step. What is one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book just to get them thinking in the right direction?
Right. Well, start by just talking to a customer. Okay, this is what I would do.
Which is the hardest thing for companies to do, I found.
I know, it's really hard. And just say, okay, what are you looking for from the product? Now, the first thing out of a customer's mind might be like, you know, and they might respond about some feature that you have. But then your job is to come back and say, why do you want that?
Yes.
Okay. And then just keep asking them, why is that important to you? What are you looking for? What is that? Just asking why questions. Why do you want that? Why do you want that? You will eventually get to, you know, something that's going on. And it might be something like, you know, something about like who I am as a person.
Yes.
You know, I need that because if without that, I can't be a member of my company with any good standing, which is more like a symbolic benefit they're looking for, like who I am as a person. And, you know, all along you thought it was this feature. And it had nothing to do with a feature. It's actually something that's going on with them, okay? And you need to understand kind of like how these benefits are working. And that's the very that's the one thing that if you took nothing else from this book, that would be the main thing that you could do right now. Now, once you take that, you know, that's why we call it a playbook. That's just play number one. But we show you how to do play number two and play number three and to the point where you can actually grow your company because we show, you know, what companies have done who do this really well.
Oh, that's such such great advice. And, you know, you said ask why questions.
Yeah.
What I want to underscore, you don't just say why five times. Which if you ask why questions and you keep asking them, I found people never mind answering them. They really appreciate. And they you'll often hear, wow, that's a good question. It really gets them thinking. It gets them very engaged.
Right, exactly.
Well, Alan, looking back, what books have most inspired your work and rather interesting career?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I must say that it's not a book so much as I think what's inspired me and inspired me to write this book and it's really did it from the very beginning was the article in Harvard Business Review by Theodore Levitt. I mean, it's not only just about marketing myopia, but he talks about the demise, and he does a really great job of explaining why the demise of companies, institutions, etc., it was all because they didn't focus on customers. And that's been kind of like the thing. I mean, at first I didn't really understand until Debbie and I started working on this book because she was the one who, you know, really understood these symbolic and experiential as well as functional. I used to call them, before I met her, I used to call these things features. No, I didn't call them features. I called them I called them something, but they weren't benefits. I just called them what things, you know. But I was just trying to focus on customers because that's as much as I knew about them. But yeah, it's an entertaining article.
Yeah.
And, but it really shows like, you know, about companies and some really, you know, big companies who like we give the example of like Arm & Hammer, you know, that, you know, if they just were like a baking soda company, right? That would just be baking soda. But when you get into the minds of customers, they realize that it actually reduced odor, okay? And people, and you saw this years and years ago, people used to put baking soda in their refrigerators because it would absorb the odors in the refrigerators.
And then put it down the sink.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I had to laugh in the book. You were talking about Arm & Hammer, and I thought, you know, my dog who's fast asleep behind me, he has these poop bags.
Yeah.
They have Arm & Hammer logos on them, and they actually smell good.
Yeah, that's exactly that's what they did. They moved into every single, you know, toothpaste and everything. You know, they were able to move into every single market because of this one. They understood that this was the benefit that people were looking for. You know, and so I'm just a real believer in this idea, and. And that's really that's really been the one thing that's in marketing, you know, that I can speak to, because most of the marketing books, you know, are just a hodgepodge of stuff, you know, and they don't lay it out, and most of the books, you know, are dealing with one small facet of it, like branding or another thing that's just one thing. And I guess maybe it's just my mind. I'm looking for something that's integrated and consistent and simple and clear and, you know, and has this process, which is why we call it a playbook, because a playbook has a process to it.
Right. And it's very practical, and you can actually go and do this. And
yeah,
books, a lot of them may be a hodgepodge, not the ones on this show, of course, but that might explain why my brain is sort of a hodgepodge. But, you know, that is such a great answer, because that article, which I will include a link to at this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com, that article has been mentioned so many times on this show, and it's been mentioned in a lot of books. And it always,
I know.
When for me, the big takeaway was like the railroads thought they were in the railroad business, the business of building railroads and moving locomotives on them. And they didn't realize that they were in the business of getting people and things from point A to point B. And they completely missed out on air cargo, trucking, shipping.
Think about Coke. They used to be in the soda business, and they reimagined themselves in the refreshment business.
Mm.
Okay, mm-hmm. And once you're in the refreshment business, that's a whole different world, right? Now all of a sudden, there's products that are not soda products, but are now that you now see as competition with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a bad thing, but it's a good thing, because now you can see where competitors, you know, could be coming from. And it also shows you where you can grow. And so I think it's a really important way for companies to start thinking. And quite frankly, if you're the only business in your industry or something that does this, you'll be in a much better position than all your competitors, you know, because that's just the way it is.
You know, it brings to mind, there's a book that's going to be on the show pretty soon by Charlie Dawson called The Customer Copernicus, How to Be Customer Led.
Yeah.
And it's a similar thing I'm sensing, where in the day, Copernicus said, hey, folks, I don't mean to upset folks, but I think the Earth might actually be rotating around the sun. Now, he got in a lot of trouble for that, and he got a lot of pushback, but he was right. And the same thing with companies, they're very focused on themselves rather than the customer. So when they make that move, suddenly it's rather dramatic. So are there any recent or upcoming books you recommend or looking forward to reading, perhaps now that you have a little more time to read books?
Well, I don't really have much time to read, I must say. but I'm not sure what books are coming out, but I'm always on the lookout, I must say, because I really like learning, and I like learning new things. And
said the founder of Marketing Profs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, me too. And I think a lot of listeners are the same way. So,
okay.
We'll keep on the lookout. And if you know any that might be a good fit for the Marketing Book Podcast, you know, help a brother out there, Alan.
Well, thank you.
Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, and the book website, brandbenefitsplaybook.com, and your LinkedIn profile. And listen, you know what? I got two copies of your book for some reason. I think you may have sent one, and Peter Knox may have sent one.
That's probably what happened.
So yeah. I am going to give that extra copy, the one that I didn't mark up and write jokes in the columns, I'm going to give that away to a listener. So if you want to, if you can share this interview or tag us or something like that, please let me know, or I'll find you and I'll send you that copy. And it's not going to be autographed, because I'm not going to autograph it, but it's a terrific book, and I think it's one that's going to be enormously helpful. So, but folks, if you do nothing else, please reach out to Alan, congratulate him on the book, thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast, putting up the foolishness of the host. If nothing else, just share the interview, maybe on LinkedIn, tag us so we can thank you. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Two final quotes. Come on, Alan. You're not going to get away without me throwing in a couple more great quotes. From page 212, we believe that organizations really want to serve their customers and have an inherent desire to be customer-focused. The best way to really focus on customers is by focusing on the benefits they seek. And page 217, if you focus your attention on benefits rather than product features, characteristics, and attributes, you will point your organization toward new products and services that solve customers' real problems. The result is likely to be more customers and greater revenues. The book is the Brand Benefits Playbook, Why Customers Aren't Buying What You're Selling and What to Do About It. The authors are Alan Weiss and Debbie McInnes. Alan, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Douglas. I've really had a great time.
All right!
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable, it's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.